Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. By tomorrow at this time, we expect to have a version of the Mueller report. We don't know how much will be blacked out, what they call redacted, but it should contain, it better contain, a lot more information than the four-page statement about the report that Attorney General Barr released last month, which contained fewer than 50 words and no complete sentences from the actual report. What it did quote Mueller saying, remember, is that he, quote, did not establish that members of the Trump campaign conspired or coordinated with the Russian government, unquote. And on obstruction of justice, quote, while this report does not conclude that the president committed a crime, it also does not exonerate him. Now, assuming the report is out by 10 a.m. tomorrow, we expect to spend tomorrow's show reading excerpts for you and trying to understand what they mean. Right now, for our first segment today, we'll try to give you kind of a listener's guide for what to expect and what questions are people looking to have answered. So with me now are Andrea Bernstein, co-host of WNYC's Trump Inc. podcast, and Rosalind Helderman, Washington Post reporter, focusing on political enterprise stories and investigations, who has been following this story closely. Hi, Andrea. Hi, Rosalind.
Hey, Brian.
Hello. How are you?
Good, thank you. So this is being released tomorrow morning. Rosalind, have they said what time?
They have not said what time, but our best understanding at the moment is the morning. There's a possibility we'll get more information during the day today, but we shall see.
Is there a reason, Andrea, to withhold the time of release until the last minute?
Is there a reason for any of this? I mean, I think that the answer is we just don't know.
Barr had said the release will be within a week. I think that was on Tuesday of last week, if I'm not mistaken. But in any case, it'll be a few days later than what he originally predicted. Do you know, Rosalind, if something took longer to redact or otherwise prepare than Barr thought?
You know, we don't know. You know, they had originally said mid-April. He did say on the Hill, I think on Tuesday, within a week. I think the following day on the Hill, he said next week. I would say that, you know, we have not encountered serious delays beyond what they had said. We're in the zone, the mid-April zone of what he had originally said.
Yeah. And there's a theory that, you know, you can hear some Democrats and liberal media espouse that the Thursday release is time to get as little publicity for this report as possible, Andrea. People are recalling that William Barr was the attorney general for George H.W. Bush when Bush pardoned people, which had implications for himself in the Iran-Contra scandal back in 1992. And when did William Barr and George H.W. Bush release those pardons? Christmas Eve. So now we're going into the Good Friday, Easter, Passover
right.
weekend.
Right. I mean, I think it is important to remember that the next day is Good Friday and the start of Passover, and people's attentions will be elsewhere. But beyond that, I mean, I think we just need to look back to what has happened so far, which is that Barr has released his conclusions. All that we have seen from the actual Mueller report is a couple of sentence fragments. So there has clearly been a manipulation thus far of the information that has come out. There was President Trump enjoyed a whole very big news cycle of his saying, I am exonerated, total exoneration, even though that is actually not what the Barr letter said. So I think that there is good reason to be mistrustful based on what has already happened. But we'll know tomorrow much more. And I think the very important question that we want to see is how much of the report are we seeing, and are we seeing what we don't see? So, for example, will it look like the court documents that have been redacted in the various Mueller cases where we know which specific sections are we not seeing, or will that be a mystery? That is what I am looking at more than the question of is it being released the day before Passover, which is without a doubt, I think, inconvenient for many people.
Right. Though these days, it's not 1992 anymore. Social media goes 24/7. It doesn't take holidays off. If there's stuff to talk about, I imagine it will spread, and it will certainly spill over into the news cycles of Monday and on next week. Rosalind, do you know the format or main sections? Have they announced that in helping people know what to look for?
No, not especially. Barr's original letter, or his letter where his non-summary summary letter indicated that the report appears to be in two parts. That seemed to be what his letter said. The first part, we believe, is on the question of conspiracy. Was there, and we know from Barr's letter that the Mueller team could not establish a criminal conspiracy between anyone associated with Trump and Russia. I think that part of the report will also probably deal, if we're allowed to see it, in more detail with more about what Mueller's team discovered about what the Russians actually did in the campaign. We know there have been two indictments related to the Russian operation, and we may learn more about that in the first part of the report. And then our understanding is that the second part deals with the question of obstruction, this very thorough factual recounting of acts the president took that raised obstruction of justice concerns, and this analysis that we don't yet fully understand by the special counsel's team of whether or not that constituted a crime.
We're speaking with Rosalind Helderman from The Washington Post and WNYC's Andrea Bernstein, co-host of our Trump Inc. podcast, in advance of tomorrow's release of a version of the Mueller report. And we can take questions for them at 212-433-WNYC, or you can say what questions you hope will be answered by this version of the report, however redacted it might be. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Let's get into what Barr did actually reveal from the Mueller report itself, those little snippets and what they tell us. Barr's statement says, or I should say, it quotes Mueller as saying, "The investigation did not establish that members of the Trump campaign conspired or coordinated with the Russian government in its election interference activities." Now, Andrea, Trump's response to that was, "There, you see, no collusion." But I'm keying on the words "did not establish," or even the single word "establish." What does it mean there, and what does it tell us?
I think this gets to the core questions and the feeling of sort of dissatisfaction and disorientation that those of us who have been following this investigation from the beginning, and also shout out to Rosalind, who has found out many, many pieces of things that were in Mueller's indictments before they were actually in the court papers. But thinking about the role that Mueller has played in our society since he began issuing indictments and legal papers, it is a time where there has been so little truth-telling, so much obfuscation, withholding of documents, non-disclosure from the Trump administration to unprecedented proportions. And what Mueller's papers and indictments have done is pierced through and given us all of this information. And there was the sort of crucible of the Paul Manafort trial, this sort of back and forth where you actually do get to the truth. And there were guilty pleas. And we learned so many things that we didn't know at the beginning of this investigation. So, to sort of reduce it to a sentence fragment, "did not establish," when we already know so many things that have come out in the court cases, is, I think, the sort of big question on my mind, and probably on other people that are looking at this, is how does that square with the fact that since this investigation, I mean, let's take one example. Let's take Michael Cohen and the Trump Tower Moscow. We know that the President Trump's personal attorney and his executive vice president and special counsel sought help from the Russians in getting financing and in getting a site location for the Trump Tower Moscow from the Kremlin. Yes. During the campaign, and then lied about it.
And let me play 26 seconds of Michael Cohen's opening statement when he testified before Congress the other week.
You need to know that Mr. Trump's personal lawyers reviewed and edited my statement to Congress about the timing of the Moscow Tower negotiations before I gave it. So to be clear, Mr. Trump knew of and directed the Trump-Moscow negotiations throughout the campaign and lied about it. He lied about it because he never expected to win.
So, Andrea, let's assume that everything Michael Cohen just said there is true. It's not a crime to direct negotiations over a building deal. It's not even a crime, I don't think, to lie to the public about it while you're running for president. It was a crime for Michael Cohen to lie to Congress about it under oath, which is what he was admitting there. But remember, the Mueller statement quoted by Barr said the investigation did not establish that members of the Trump campaign conspired or coordinated with the Russian government in its election interference activities.
Right.
So what's the relationship between what Michael Cohen said there, what you were just describing, and anything having to do with election interference?
Well, we don't know is the answer, and that's one of the things I'm very much going to be looking to understand tomorrow. We do know that Michael Cohen was a part of the Trump campaign. We do know that he was keeping both the Trump family, President Trump, or then head of the Trump Organization, Donald Trump, Don Jr., and Ivanka briefed on this 10 times, it said in the court papers, which, by the way, the sort of court papers that the special counsel's office files, when they file something and they say this happened as part of a guilty plea situation, that means this is what happened. It doesn't mean this is our opinion. It doesn't mean we are accusing such and such. It means here's the truth. So in this era where there is so little sense of like, okay, here's where the truth is, that's the truth, that Michael Cohen did those things. And we know, in addition to that, he coordinated with members of the campaign. He told them about it. They discussed President Trump's taking a trip to Moscow. So what we don't yet understand is how the different pieces of this fit together, but we know someone who was very, very close to President Trump was seeking assistance from a hostile foreign power under U.S. sanctions at the very time that that hostile foreign power was attacking our democracy.
So, Rosalind, what would you add on the conspiracy and coordination piece in terms of very particular questions, like Andrea was just articulating from her standpoint, that you hope that Mueller will answer in this report tomorrow, or anything else?
Yeah, well, first off, you know, thank you for that shout out from Andrea earlier, who has also done amazing work. You know, one thing I would note is there was a line in the Barr letter that got a lot less attention because he didn't actually quote from Mueller about this. But and I don't have the letter in front of me, so I can't quote it directly. But he actually did sort of in half a clause mention Mueller's finding of attempts by Russian outreach to the campaign. And so, you know, we obviously know that that happened. We know about the Trump Tower meeting. We know about a number of other examples. But I'm very interested to learn if there are additional examples, additional moments where it looks like Russia was feeling out the Trump campaign, was sending cutouts, sending emissaries, regardless of whether the Mueller team established that there was anything criminal that occurred in the course of those interactions. The other thing is, I am hoping, I'm not yet sure whether this is going to be the case, but I'm hoping that some of these longstanding questions that we've had might be answered. You know, what was the deal with Carter Page, volunteer foreign policy advisor named to the Trump campaign in the spring of 2016, who had already had interactions with people the government said were Russian intelligence officers back in 2013, I believe, went to Moscow during the campaign. Our government surveilled him secretly for, you know, nearly a year. Whatever happened with that? He was never charged with a crime. Is there going to be a section, and are we going to be allowed to read it on what they actually learned about him and why they believed, you know, that he was worth investigating but did not decide to charge him? What happened with Jerry Corsi, the conservative author who, with great fanfare, announced in the fall that the Mueller team wanted him to plead guilty to lying to them, actually made public the draft court document that Mueller's prosecutors drew up for him? He was never charged. Why not? Are we going to learn about that? We'll find out.
And with respect to that whole area related to Corsi, Roger Stone, who was indicted, but he wasn't indicted on conspiring with Russia to affect the election. And yet he had claimed that he was in contact with WikiLeaks and told the Trump people about WikiLeaks' intent to release damaging emails regarding Hillary Clinton, all of which raises other little breadcrumbs having to do with possible conspiracy with Russia, but it doesn't close the loop.
One of the big...
Yeah, that's exactly...
Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Russ.
Oh, I was just going to say that, and of course, he later denied that he was in contact with WikiLeaks. So, you know, did they decide he wasn't? Did they decide they believed he might have been, but they could never prove it? That we just don't know.
And I was just going to say that one of the lingering mysteries about that indictment was there was this very famous use of the passive voice in that indictment. Roger Stone was directed to see what WikiLeaks was going to do next. Who directed that? There's a lot of sort of breadcrumbs throughout the Mueller indictments and guilty pleas. There was the one involving Michael Flynn, who pleaded guilty, being in touch with a very senior transition official, I think was the phrasing, or something to that effect, who has been identified maybe by Roz as Jared Kushner. Well, what was Jared Kushner doing directing Michael Flynn and on a, it was having to do with a vote in the UN about sanctions and on reaching out to the Russians about that. So what is Jared Kushner's liability on that? What about Jared Kushner's meeting with the Russian banker Gorkov that took place at Trump Tower that he's talked about publicly, where he said he was discussing the transition and they said they were discussing the Kushner family business? So there are many, many things that we've learned about through Mueller's legal papers that don't have answers. Well, what else did they find? And what was this person doing? And these are not obviously random people. This is, you know, Jared Kushner is still senior White House advisor, not to mention Donald Trump. So exactly what they did and how they responded and what they knew are just huge questions, and which is a separate question from did they collude with the Russian government in their hack of the United States. The question is, what, when these officials were presented with information and circumstances, did they do, which is a much more important question in some ways for the future of the democracy than was a crime committed, or perhaps as important a question.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. As for context, we're going over some of the questions that people who've been following the Mueller investigation closely hope will be answered by the release of his report tomorrow, or at least a redacted version of it, which Attorney General Barr says will be tomorrow morning. And as long as it happens early enough in the morning, we'll be going over it in detail and hopefully providing answers to these questions on tomorrow's show. We're getting this context from WNYC's Andrea Bernstein, who's the co-host of our Trump Inc. podcast, which is about Trump's business world and the questions Andrea was just asking, obviously relate to that intersection between Trump's businesses and the public interest, and with Rosalind Helderman, investigations reporter for The Washington Post. And we'll go to some of your phone calls in a minute for some questions on this at 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. I just want to refer first, Rosalind, to the other snippet that Barr gave us from the Mueller report itself on obstruction of justice, in which Mueller wrote, quote, "While this report does not conclude that the president committed a crime, it also does not exonerate him." And that had a lot of people scratching their heads for various reasons. One, why didn't Mueller reach a conclusion one way or another? Wasn't that his job? And also thinking about clips like this, spoken by Trump himself, and why these don't, in and of themselves, indicate that he acted in such a way as to obstruct an investigation into him. This is Trump, the famous clip with Lester Holt after he fired FBI Director James Comey.
When I decided to just do it, I said to myself, I said, you know, this Russia thing with Trump and Russia is a made-up story. It's an excuse by the Democrats for having lost an election.
So do you expect to hear, Rosalind, from Mueller's own lips, at least in writing tomorrow, why things like that weren't enough to charge the president or conclude that the president would be guilty of obstruction of justice?
Yeah, I do think that we're going to get some sense of that. I mean, what Barr has indicated is that Mueller's team made, this is actually a quote from their report, a quote, thorough factual investigation of these various episodes that raised obstruction of justice concerns. We know that Barr indicated that most of them have been the subject of public reporting. So I think there'll be a lot of analysis of things that people already think they know about, the firing of Comey, the moment where the president tells Comey in the Oval Office that he hopes that he can let the Flynn investigation go, things like that. But of course, saying most of them have been the subject of public reporting certainly suggests that some of them have not been. So that's certainly something that I'm going to be looking for very carefully. What are the additional examples that they analyzed that we didn't actually know about before? And apparently he sort of goes through an analysis of each of these episodes and looks at the evidence on both sides of whether or not to consider that episode a crime. You know, the attorney general said that he looked at evidence on both sides of the question, but found that there were, quote, difficult issues of law and fact. So I think we'll hear a lot from him about each of these episodes and why he considered each of them to be difficult, either from a legal or factual perspective.
Jonathan in Tarrytown. You're on WNYC with Trump Inc. co-host Andrea Bernstein and Rosalind Helderman from The Washington Post. Hi, Jonathan.
Hi. Great show. Thank you so much. I'm very interested in what this report's going to reveal. My question is, if the report shows that there was no conspiracy beyond a reasonable doubt, what about a compromise of the president or his campaign? If we know that Michael Cohen said the president lied about the Trump Tower meeting and perhaps, about the Moscow Tower, and Russia knew he was lying, does anyone think there will be information in the report about the possible compromise of Trump or the campaign as a result of Russia having information that Donald Trump and his campaign were lying?
Great question. Andrea, you want to take that one?
I mean, I think that is a very, very important question about what I'm going to be looking at tomorrow, because I understand that the White House is going to be looking at the question of obstruction of justice. But the story about what happened, insofar as we are told, is going to be more likely told in the section about conspiracy. So how that mechanism worked, I think, is going to be hugely important, because
that could be a bombshell if it comes out in the way Jonathan was characterizing, right? Because it's not a crime to be compromised by Russia, so there wouldn't be an indictment of Trump there necessarily. But if Mueller concludes, and Barr hasn't told us yet, that the president of the United States is compromised because Russia has embarrassing information on him, that's a bombshell.
Right. Well, I mean, it wouldn't be embarrassing anymore because, you know, we all know about it. Did they attempt to deploy it during the campaign in any way, I think is the you know, sort of big question. I mean, I think you and I think have talked about this before, about how we know from the Trump Organization that they did not do extensive due diligence on their business partners, that they would seemingly do business with almost everyone. And it seems like a not very long walk from that to asking the Kremlin for a favor, to telling the American people we didn't do any business with them, so then the Kremlin knows that you have lied to the public. So I think that there's going to be, you know, a lot of interesting storytelling there. I mean, I think one of the really important things to watch out for tomorrow is that in his summary, non-summary letter, Barr said that he, or indicated that he didn't like the idea of sort of coming down on the side of guilty of, or, you know, probable cause for obstruction of justice when there was no underlying crime. But one question that I have is, okay, well, what was the underlying activity, A, and B, was there something else that Trump was trying to cover up? For example, there were reports that Trump got very angry about a reported attempt to subpoena Deutsche Bank, and that then the reports go Trump tried to fire Mueller over that. Well, did that happen? Was that possibly obstructive behavior? And was it obstructing an inquiry into something else other than conspiracy with Russia in the 2016 campaign? So I think that there's a lot of questions that Barr's original letter tried to set us thinking in another direction. And I think something that's going to be very important for all of us is to sort of think, okay, well, what do we know and what are we seeing from the facts that are laid out before us, which I hope they will be.
WNYC's Andrea Bernstein, co-host of the Trump Inc. podcast. You're going to have a special edition like tomorrow night.
We are going to have a special dessert. I don't know if it's going to be tomorrow night. It depends exactly when it's released. But soon after the release, we're going to be sort of analyzing what we've learned about Trump and his business, looking very specifically at that, and also the people around him. For example, we spent a lot of time reporting on Manafort. And one of the big lingering questions, even though Manafort was convicted and has pleaded guilty and was sentenced, we still don't know, did he try to monetize his relationship with the Trump campaign by getting an oligarch to forgive debts? Why was he sharing polling information with the Russians, as we inadvertently learned from a non-redacted, by mistake, court document? What was the meeting where he was meeting with the person, Konstantin Kilimnik, who Mueller believes was a Russian intelligence asset, where they discussed big caviar? So there are still a number of questions.
Polling data, private
right.
Trump campaign polling data.
Exactly.
Right?
So it's not specifically Trump's business, but it is somebody at the top of the Trump campaign maybe trying to monetize that position to get personal advantage from his political position. So we may learn more about
that. And I think you gave us a great framing a minute ago, which is the only thing to learn from, or let's say, who committed what crime or would be charged with what crime is not the only thing to learn from the Mueller report. There are many big questions for our democracy, short of criminal activity, that we also might learn important things about from the report tomorrow. So, Andrea, thank you for that context. We'll talk again tomorrow.
Thank you.
And we have a few minutes left still with Rosalind Helderman from The Washington Post, and I think a very pertinent question from Andrew in Essex County. Andrew, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Good morning, everyone. My point is this. I've seen on social media recently the idea that Mr. Mueller did not refer Trump for federal criminal charges intentionally, but rather is allowing the states to have state criminal charges filed against him, such as the Southern District, because, this is what they said, state charges are not pardonable. And I'm wondering if your guests can shed some light on the truth or the idea behind that.
Andrew, thank you. And not just state charges, but Roslyn, I wonder if Mueller's decisions on indicting Trump, even at the federal level, are the last word. Like, it's the U.S. Attorney's Office here in New York that mostly prosecuted Michael Cohen and therefore could have incriminating evidence regarding Trump on who knows what that that Mueller hasn't even seen. And then a whole other shoe drops sometime after tomorrow at the federal level or the state level. How possible is that?
Well, I think one thing that we learned over time, and we are likely to learn even more tomorrow, is that Bob Mueller took the mandate that he was given in his appointment very seriously. You know, there was this great concern growing out of the 90s and the Starr investigation about mandate creep. So his mandate was Russia. What Russia did in the election, ties between Russia and the Trump campaign, and then crimes that might arise in reaction to that investigation, which is to say obstruction. Everything else, he spun out to other offices. Because he's a pretty by-the-book guy, I would imagine some of those investigations will be described in the report, those ongoing investigations. But that is one of the areas that we've been told will be redacted. And the attorney general is on particularly solid legal ground to redact information that relates to ongoing legal investigations. So I would not necessarily guess we're going to learn a lot about what remains ongoing tomorrow, except for perhaps by context, you know, where do redactions for that reason come within the report? What was being discussed before and after? But, you know, we'll get some sense of how much ongoing investigation Mueller described that's been redacted, but we won't necessarily learn details. I would not expect, for instance, that there'll be a section of the report describing how, you know, he believes there were financial crimes by the president and he's going to allow the states to investigate that. Mm-hmm. I would be shocked if we mm-hmm. saw anything like that in the report.
We'd have to find that out from the states or from the other U.S. attorney's offices over time. Two more things before you go, real quick. One, Barr says the redactions will be color-coded. Do you have any yeah. information or a good guess on how many colors there will be? I won't ask you which colors they'll use, but for what, but you know, for how many kinds and what kinds of redactions?
Yeah, I think our current understanding is there's going to be four colors, and they're going to cover the four sections he described in his testimony and letter were going to be redacted. And let me see if I can remember them offhand. One is grand jury material. Two is ongoing investigations. Three is classified material or material that would reveal intelligence sources and methods. And the fourth, which I think is the in some ways the absolute fuzziest, is material that would implicate the privacy rights of peripheral uncharged third parties. Hmm. And so what you consider a peripheral uncharged third party is I will be interested to see. Is that Carter Page? Is that Jared Kushner? Who's a peripheral third party? I wouldn't consider either of those two players peripheral, but we'll see what the attorney general does.
And I can already see Saturday Night Live on the color coding. The blue redactions are for incriminating evidence against Trump about collusion that they don't want you to see. The green redactions are for the proof that Trump committed obstruction that we don't want you to see. The orange redactions are everything about Jared Kushner, peripheral guy who we don't want you to see. We will see how that plays out. And then the last thing is, there's been this belief, Rosalind, among many people that Mueller is like God. You know, Mueller knows all. When little pieces of the story would come to light in the press from your reporting or others, like the Trump Tower meeting or the various lies about contacts with Russia by so many people around Trump, or a piece of evidence from Michael Cohen's Trump files, people would say, well, we don't know where this all adds up to, but Mueller knows all. Do you think we'll learn tomorrow that Mueller does not know all, that Mueller is not God, and he just couldn't get to the bottom of some of the central questions?
Well, I guess we're going to know in 24 hours. I mean, my gut tells me, yeah, we're going to learn that these were human beings doing this investigation and that they had enormous resources and they learned far more than the rest of us knew at the time. And they're going to tell us some of it. But yeah, some things are really hard to discover. And I think we are going to learn a bit about the limits of human investigative power, particularly when it's time limited.
Rosalind Helderman, investigations reporter for The Washington Post, thank you so much for helping us get ready for this tomorrow.
Thank you for having me.
And again, listeners, we will do as much coverage as warranted on tomorrow's show. They say the report is going to be out tomorrow morning. We don't know if that's 3 o'clock in the morning. We don't know if that's 11:55 in the morning. But we will tell you everything we can tell you on tomorrow's Brian Lehrer Show. And we'll tell you a lot more about other things coming up right after this.